Zane's words then meant something important. He felt himself to be an outsider, a little like herself. It was a weakness in him, certainly. Perhaps she could turn him against Straff. His willingness to spar with her, his willingness to reveal himself, hinted at that much. She breathed in deeply of the cool mist air, her heart still beating quickly from the exchange. She felt tired, yet alive, from fighting someone who might actually be better than she was. Standing in the mists atop the wall of an abandoned keep, she decided something. She had to keep sparring with Zane.
If only the deepness hadn't come when it did, providing a threat that drove men to desperation, both in action and belief.
18.
Kill him,
God whispered. Zane hung quietly in the mists, looking through Ellen Venture's open balcony doors. The mists swirled around him, obscuring him from the king's view.
You should kill him, God said again.
In a way, Zane hated Elland, though he had never met the man before today. Elland was everything that Zane should have been. Favored, privileged, pampered. He was Zane's enemy, a block in the road to domination. The thing that was keeping Straff, and therefore Zane, from ruling the central dominance. But he was also Zane's brother. Zane let himself drop through the mists, falling silently to the ground outside Keep Venture. He pulled his anchors up into his hand, three small bars he had been pushing on to hold himself in place. Vin would be returning soon, and he didn't want to be near the keep when she did. She had a strange ability to know where he was. Her senses were far more keen than any allomancer he had ever known or fought. Of course, she had been trained by the survivor himself.
I would have liked to have known him, Zane thought as he moved quietly across the courtyard. He was a man who understood the power of being mistborn, a man who didn't let others control him. A man who did what had to be done, no matter how ruthless it seemed.
Or so the rumors said. Zane paused beside the outer keep wall, below a buttress. He stooped, removing a cobblestone, and found the message left there by his spy inside Ellen's palace. Zane retrieved it, replaced the cobblestone, then dropped a coin and launched himself out into the night. Zane did not slink, nor did he creep, skulk, or cower. In fact, he didn't even like to hide. So he approached the Venture Army camp with a determined stride. It seemed to him that Mistborn spent too much of their existence hiding. True, anonymity offered some limited freedom. However, his experience had been that it bound them more than it freed them. It let them be controlled, and it let society pretend that they didn't exist. Zane strode toward a guard post where two soldiers sat beside a large fire. He shook his head. They were virtually useless, blinded by the firelight. Normal men feared the mists, and that made them less valuable. That wasn't arrogance, it was a simple fact. Allomancers were more useful and therefore more valuable than normal men. That was why Zane had tin eyes watching in the darkness as well. Those regular soldiers were more a formality than anything else.
Kill them, God commanded as Zane walked up to the guard post.
Zane ignored the voice, though it was growing more and more difficult to do so.
Halt, one of the guards said, lowering a spear. Who is that?
Zane pushed the spear offhandedly, flipping up the tip.
Who else would it be? He snapped, walking into the firelight.
Lord Zane, the other soldier said.
Summon the king, Zane said, passing the guard post. Tell him to meet me in the command tent.
But, my lord, the guard said, the hour is late. His majesty is probably...
Zane turned, giving the guard a flat stare.
The mists swirled between them. Zane didn't even have to use emotional allomancy on the soldier. The man simply saluted, then rushed off into the night to do as commanded. Zane strode through the camp. He wore no uniform or mist cloak, but soldiers stopped and saluted as he passed. This was the way it should be. They knew him, knew what he was, knew to respect him. And yet a part of him acknowledged that if Straff hadn't kept his bastard son hidden, Zane might not be the powerful weapon that he was today. That secrecy had forced Zane to live a life of near squalor, while his half-brother Elland had been privileged. But it also meant that Straff had been able to keep Zane hidden for most of his life. Even still, while rumors were growing about the existence of Straff's Mistborn, few realized that Zane was Straff's son. Plus, living a harsh life had taught Zane to survive on his own. He had become hard and powerful, things he suspected Elland would never understand. Unfortunately, one side effect of his childhood was that it had apparently driven him mad. "Kill him," God whispered as Zane passed another guard. The voice spoke every time he saw a person. It was Zane's quiet, constant companion. He understood that he was insane. It hadn't really been all that hard to determine, all things considered. Normal people didn't hear voices. Zane did. He found insanity no excuse, however, for irrational behavior. Some men were blind, others had poor tempers, still others heard voices. It was all the same in the end. A man was defined not by his flaws, but by how he overcame them. And so Zane ignored the voice. He killed when he wanted to, not when it commanded. In his estimation, he was actually quite lucky. Other madmen saw visions, or couldn't distinguish their delusions from reality. Zane, at least, could control himself. For the most part. He pushed on the metal clasps on the flaps of the command tent. The flaps flipped backward, opening for him as the soldiers to either side saluted. Zane ducked inside.
"My lord," said the Night Watch officer of command.
"Kill him," said God. "He's really not that important."
"Paper," Zane ordered, walking to the room's large table. The officer scrambled to comply, grabbing a stack of sheets. Zane pulled on the nib of the pen, flipping it across the room to his waiting hand. The officer brought the ink.
"There are troop concentrations and night patrols," Zane said, scribbling down some numbers and diagrams on the paper. "I observed them tonight while I was in Lutherdell."
"Very good, my lord," the soldier said. "We appreciate your help."
Zane paused. Then he slowly continued to write.
"Soldier, you are not my superior. You aren't even my equal. I am not helping you. I am seeing to the needs of my army. Do you understand?"
"Of course, my lord."
"Good," Zane said, finishing his notes and handing the paper to the soldier. "Now leave, or I'll do as a friend has suggested and ram this pen through your throat." The soldier accepted the paper, then quickly withdrew. Zane waited impatiently. Straff did not arrive. Finally, Zane cursed quietly and pushed open the tent flaps and strode out. Straff's tent was a blazing red beacon in the night, well lit by numerous lanterns. Zane passed the guards, who knew better than to bother him, and entered the king's tent. Straff was having a late dinner. He was a tall man, brown of hair, like both his sons, the two important ones, at least. He had fine nobleman's hands, which he used to eat with finesse. He didn't react as Zane entered.
"You're late," Straff said.
"Kill him," God said.
Zane clenched his fists. This command from the voice was the hardest to ignore.
"Yes," he said. "I'm late."
"What happened tonight?" Straff asked.
Zane glanced at the servants. We should do this in the command tent.
Straff continued to sip his soup, staying where he was, implying that Zane had no power to order him about. It was frustrating, but not unexpected. Zane had used virtually the same tactic on the Night Watch officer just moments before. He had learned from the best. Finally, Zane sighed, taking a seat. He rested his arms on the table, idly spinning a dinner knife as he watched his father eat. A servant approached to ask Zane if he wanted a meal, but he waved the man away.
"Kill Straff," God commanded. "You should be in his place. You are stronger than he is. You are more competent." "But I'm not as sane," Zane thought.
"Well," Straff asked, "do they have the Lord Ruler's Atrium or not?"
"I'm not sure," Zane said.
"Does the girl trust you?" Straff asked.
"She's beginning to," Zane said. "I did see her use Atium that once, fighting Set's assassins."
Straff nodded thoughtfully. He really was competent. Because of him, the Northern Dominance had avoided the chaos that prevailed in the rest of the Final Empire. Straff's ska remained under control, his noblemen quelled. True, he had been forced to execute a number of people to prove that he was in charge. But he did what needed to be done. That was one attribute in a man that Zane respected above all others. Especially since he had trouble displaying it himself.
"Kill him!" God yelled. "You hate him! He kept you in squalor, forcing you to fight for your survival as a child." "He made me strong," Zane thought. "Then use that strength to kill him."
Zane grabbed the carving knife off the table. Straff looked up from his meal, then flinched just slightly as Zane sliced the flesh of his own arm. He cut a long gash into the top of his forearm, drawing blood. The pain helped him resist the voice. Straff watched for a moment, then waved for a servant to bring Zane a towel so he wouldn't get blood on the rug.
"You need to get her to use Atium again," Straff said. "Elland may have been able to gather one or two beads. We'll only know the truth if she runs out."
He paused, turning back to his meal.
"Actually, what you need to do is get her to tell you where the stash is hidden, if they even have it."
Zane sat, watching the blood seep from the gash on his forearm.
"She's more capable than you think, father."
Straff raised an eyebrow.
"Don't tell me you believe those stories, Zane. The lies about her and the Lord Ruler."
"How do you know they are lies?"
"Because of Elland," Straff said. "That boy is a fool. He only controls Lúthedain because every nobleman with half a wit in his head fled the city. If that girl were powerful enough to defeat the Lord Ruler, I sincerely doubt that your brother could ever have gained her loyalty."
Zane cut another slice in his arm. He didn't cut deeply enough to do any real damage, and the pain worked as it usually did. Straff finally turned from his meal, masking a look of discomfort. A small, twisted piece of Zane took pleasure from seeing that look in his father's eyes. Perhaps it was a side effect of his insanity.
"Anyway," Straff said, "did you meet with Elland?"
Zane nodded. He turned to a serving girl.
"Tea," he said, waving his uncut arm. "Elland was surprised. He wanted to meet with you, but he obviously didn't like the idea of coming into your camp. I doubt he'll come."
"Perhaps," Straff said. "But don't underestimate the boy's foolishness. Either way, perhaps now he understands how our relationship will proceed."
So much posturing, Zane thought.
By sending this message, Straff took a stand. He wouldn't be ordered about or even inconvenienced on Ellen's behalf.
"Being forced into a siege inconvenienced you, though," Zane thought with a smile.
What Straff would have liked to do was attack directly, taking the city without parley or negotiations. The arrival of the Second Army made that impossible. Attack now and Straff would be defeated by Set.
That meant waiting. Waiting in a siege. Until Elland saw reason and joined with his father willingly. But waiting was something Straff disliked. Zane didn't mind as much. It would give him more time to spar with the girl. He smiled. As the tea arrived, Zane closed his eyes, then burned tin to enhance his senses. His wounds burst to life, minor pains becoming great, shocking him to wakefulness. There was a part of all this he wasn't telling Straff. "She's coming to trust me," he thought. "And there's something else about her. She's like me. Perhaps she could understand me. Perhaps she could save me." He sighed, opening his eyes and using the towel to clean his arm. His insanity frightened him sometimes, but it seemed weaker around Vin. That was all he had to go on for the moment. He accepted his tea from the serving girl, long braid, firm chest, homely features, and took a sip of the hot cinnamon. Straff raised his own cup, then hesitated, sniffing delicately. He eyed Zane.
"Poisoned tea, Zane."
Zane said nothing.
"Birchbane, too," Straff noted. "That's a depressingly unoriginal move for you."
Zane said nothing. Straff made a cutting motion. The girl looked up with terror as one of Straff's guards stepped toward her. She glanced at Zane, expecting some sort of aid, but he just looked away. She yelled pathetically as the guard pulled her off to be executed.
"She wanted the chance to kill him," he thought. "I told her it probably wouldn't work."
Straff just shook his head. Though not a full Mistborn, the king was a Tin-Eye. Still, even for one with such an ability, sniffing birchbane amid the cinnamon was an impressive feat.
"Zane, Zane," Straff said. "What would you do if you actually managed to kill me?"
"If I actually wanted to kill you," Zane thought, "I'd use that knife, not poison."
But he let Straff think what he wished. The king expected assassination attempts, so Zane provided them. Straff held something up, a small bead of atium.
"I was going to give you this, Zane, but I see that we'll have to wait. You need to get over these foolish attempts on my life. If you were ever to succeed, where would you get your atium?"
Straff didn't understand, of course. He thought that atium was like a drug, and assumed that Mistborn relished using it. Therefore, he thought he could control Zane with it. Zane let the man continue in his misapprehension, never explaining that he had his own personal stockpile of the metal. That, however, brought him to face the real question that dominated his life. God's whispers were returning now that the pain was fading. And of all the people the voice whispered about, Straff Venture was the one who most deserved to die.
"Why?" God asked. "Why won't you kill him?"
Zane looked down at his feet.
"Because he's my father," he thought, finally admitting his weakness.
Other men did what they had to. They were stronger than Zane.
"You're insane, Zane," Straff said.
Zane looked up.
"Do you really think you could conquer the Empire yourself if you were to kill me? Considering your particular malady, do you think you could run even a city?"
Zane looked away.
"No."
Straff nodded.
"I'm glad we both understand that."
"You should just attack," Zane said. "We can find the atium once we control Luthadel." Straff smiled, then sipped the tea. The poisoned tea. Despite himself, Zane started, sitting up straight.
"Don't presume to think you know what I'm planning, Zane," Straff said. "You don't understand half as much as you assume."
Zane sat quietly, watching his father drink the last of the tea.
"What of your spy?"
Straff asked. Zane laid the note on the table.
He's worried that they might suspect him. He has found no information about the ATM.
Straff nodded, setting down the empty cup.
You'll return to the city and continue to befriend the girl.
Zane nodded slowly, then turned and left the tent. Straff thought he could feel the birchbane already seeping through his veins, making him tremble. He forced himself to remain in control, waiting for a few moments. Once he was sure Zane was distant, he called for a guard.
Bring me Amaranta, Straff ordered. Quickly!
The soldier rushed to do his master's bidding. Straff sat quietly, tent rustling in the evening breeze, a puff of mist floating to the floor from the once-open flap. He burned tin, enhancing his senses.
Yes, he could feel the poison within him, deadening his nerves. He had time, however, as long as an hour, perhaps, and so he relaxed.
For a man who claimed he didn't want to kill Straff, Zane certainly spent a lot of effort trying. Fortunately, Straff had a tool even Zane didn't know about, one that came in the form of a woman. Straff smiled as his tin-enhanced ears heard soft footsteps approaching in the night. The soldiers sent Amaranta right in. Straff hadn't brought all of his mistresses with him on the trip, just his 10 or 15 favorites. Mixed in with the ones he was currently bedding, however, were some women that he kept for their effectiveness rather than their beauty. Amaranta was a good example. She had been quite attractive a decade before, but now she was creeping up into her late 20s. Her breasts had begun to sag from childbirth, and every time Straff looked at her, he noticed the wrinkles that were appearing on her forehead and around her eyes. He got rid of most women long before they reached her age. This one, however, had skills that were useful. If Zane heard that Straff had sent for the woman this night, he'd assume that Straff had simply wanted to bed her. He'd be wrong.
My lord,
Amaranta said, getting down on her knees. She began to disrobe. Well, at least she's optimistic, Straff thought. He would have thought that after 4 years without being called to his bed, she would understand. Didn't women realize when they were too old to be attractive?
Keep your clothing on, woman, he snapped.
Amaranta's face fell, and she laid her hands in her lap, leaving her dress half undone, one breast exposed, as if she were trying to tempt him with her aging nudity.
I need your antidote, he said, quickly.
Which one, my lord? She asked.
She wasn't the only herbalist Straff kept. He learned scents and tastes from 4 different people. Amaranta, however, was the best of them.
Birchbane, Straff said. And maybe something else, I'm not sure.
Another general potion, then, my lord?
Amaranta asked. Straff nodded curtly. Amaranta rose, walking to his poison cabinet. She lit the burner at the side, boiling a small pot of water as she quickly mixed powders, herbs, and liquids. The concoction was her particular specialty, a mixture of all the basic poison antidotes, remedies, and reagents in her repertoire. Straff suspected that Zane had used the birchbane to cover something else. Whatever it was, however, Amaranta's concoction would deal with, or at least identify it. Straff waited uncomfortably as Amaranta worked, still half naked. The concoction needed to be prepared freshly each time, but it was worth the wait. She eventually brought him a steaming mug. Straff gulped it, forcing down the harsh liquid despite its bitterness. Immediately he began to feel better. He sighed, another trap avoided, as he drank the rest of the cup to be certain. Amaranta knelt expectantly again.
Go, Straff ordered.
Amaranta nodded quietly. She put her arm back through the dress's sleeve, then retreated from the tent. Straff sat stewing, empty cup cooling in his hand. He knew he held the edge. As long as he appeared strong before Zane, the Mistborn would continue to do as commanded. Probably.
If only I had passed over Alendi when looking for an assistant all those years ago.
19. Sazed unclasped his final steel mind. He held it up, the bracelet-like band of metal glistening in the red sunlight. To another man it might seem valuable. To Sazed it was now just another empty husk. A simple steel bracelet. He could refill it if he wished, but for the moment he didn't consider the weight worth carrying. With a sigh, he dropped the bracelet. It fell with a clank, tossing up a puff of ash from the ground.
5 months of storing, of spending every fifth day drained of speed, my body moving as if impeded by a thick molasses. And now it's all gone.
The loss had purchased something valuable, however. In just 6 days of travel, using steel mines on occasion, he had traveled the equivalent of 6 weeks' worth of walking. According to his cartography copper mind, Luthadel was now a little over a week away. Sazed felt good about the expenditure. Perhaps he'd overreacted to the deaths he'd found in the little southern village. Perhaps there was no need for him to hurry. But he'd created the steel mine to be used. He hefted his pack, which was much lighter than it had been. Though many of his metal mines were small, they were heavy in aggregate. He'd decided to discard some of the less valuable or less full ones as he ran. Just like the steel bracelet, which he left sitting in the ash behind him as he went on. He was definitely in the central dominance now. He'd passed Fal East and Tirion, two of the northern ash mounds. Tirion was still just barely visible to the south, a tall, solitary peak with a cut-off, blackened top. The landscape had grown flat, the trees changing from patchy brown pines to the willowy white aspens common around Luthadel. The aspens rose like bones, growing from the black soil, clumping, their ashen white bark scarred and twisted. They... Sazed paused. He stood near the central canal, one of the main routes to Luthadel. The canal was empty of boats at the moment. Travelers were rare these days, even more rare than they had been during the Final Empire, for bandits were far more common. Sazed had outrun several groups of them during his hurried flight to Luthadel. No, solitary travelers were rare. Armies were far more common, and, judging from the several dozen trails of smoke he saw rising ahead of him, he had run afoul of one. It stood directly between him and Luthadel. He thought quietly for a moment, flakes of ash beginning to fall lightly around him. It was midday. If that army had scouts, Sazed would have a very difficult time getting around it. In addition, his steel mines were empty. He wouldn't be able to run from pursuit. And yet, an army within a week of Luthadel? Whose was it? And what threat did it pose? His curiosity, the curiosity of a scholar, prodded him to seek a vantage from which to study the troops. Vin and the others could use any information he gathered. Decision made, Sazed located a hill with a particularly large stand of aspens. He felt the familiar sensation of decreased weight, and he easily climbed to the top of the thin tree. His body was now light enough that it didn't take much strength to pull himself upward. Hanging from the very tip of the tree, Sazed tapped his tin mind. The edges of his vision fuzzed, as always, but with the increased vision, he could make out details about the large group settled into a hollow before him. He was right about it being an army. He was wrong about it being made up of men.
"By the forgotten gods," Sazed whispered, so shocked that he nearly lost his grip.
The army was organized in only the most simplistic and primitive way. There were no tents, no vehicles, no horses. Just hundreds of large cooking fires, each ringed with figures. And those figures were of a deep blue. They varied greatly in size. Some were just 5 feet tall, others were lumbering hulks of 10 feet or more. They were both the same species, Sazed knew. Kolos. The creatures, though similar to men in base form, never stopped growing.
They simply continued to get bigger as they aged, growing until their hearts could no longer support them. Then they died, killed by their body's own growth imperative. Before they died, however, they got very large. And very dangerous. Seiza dropped from the tree, making his body light enough that he hit the ground softly. He hurriedly searched through his copper mines. When he found the one he wanted, he strapped it to his upper left arm, then climbed back up the tree. He searched an index quickly. Somewhere he'd taken notes on a book about the Koloss. He'd studied it, trying to decide if the creatures had a religion. He'd had someone repeat the notes back to him so he could store them in the copper mine. He had the book memorized, too, of course, but placing so much information directly in his mind would ruin the... There, he thought, recovering the notes. He tapped them from the copper mine, filling his mind with knowledge. Most Koloss bodies gave out before they reached 20 years of age. The more ancient creatures were often a massive 12 feet in height, with stocky, powerful bodies. However, few Koloss lived that long, and not just because of heart failure. Their society, if it could be called that, was extremely violent. Excitement suddenly overcoming apprehension, Seizid tapped tin for vision again, searching through the thousands of blue humanoids, trying to get visual proof of what he'd read. It wasn't hard to find fights. Scuffles around the fires seemed common, and interestingly, they were always between Koloss of nearly the same size. Seizid magnified his view even further, gripping the tree tightly to overcome the nausea, and got his first good look at a Koloss. It was a creature of smaller size, perhaps 6 feet tall. It was man-shaped, with two arms and legs, though its neck was hard to distinguish. It was completely bald. The oddest feature, however, was its blue skin, which hung loose and folded. The creature looked like a fat man might, had all his fat been drained away, leaving the stretched skin behind. And the skin didn't seem to be connected very well. Around the creature's red blood-drop eyes, the skin sagged, revealing the facial muscles. The same was true around the mouth. The skin sagged a few inches below the chin, the lower teeth and jaw completely exposed. It was a stomach-turning sight, especially for a man who was already nauseated. The creature's ears hung low, flopping down beside its jawline. Its nose was formless and loose, with no cartilage supporting it. Skin hung baggily from the creature's arms and legs, and its only clothing was a crude loincloth. Seizid turned, selecting a larger creature, one perhaps 8 feet tall, to study. The skin on this beast wasn't as loose, but it still didn't seem to fit quite right. Its nose twisted at a crooked angle, pulled flat against the face by an enlarged head that sat on a stumpy neck. The creature turned to leer at a companion, and again the skin around its mouth didn't quite fit. The lips didn't close completely, and the holes around the eyes were too big, so they exposed the muscles beneath.
Like a person wearing a mask made of skin, Seizid thought, trying to push away his disgust. So their body continues to grow, but their skin doesn't?
His thought was confirmed as a massive 10-foot-tall beast of a Koloss wandered into the group. Smaller creatures scattered before this newcomer, who thumped up to the fire, where several horses were roasting. This largest creature's skin was pulled so tight it was beginning to tear. The hairless blue flesh had ripped around the eyes, at the edges of the mouth, and around the massive chest muscles. Seizid could see little trails of red blood dripping from the rips. Even where the skin wasn't torn, it was pulled taut. The nose and ears were so flat they were almost indistinguishable from the flesh around them. Suddenly, Seizid's study didn't seem so academic. Koloss had come to the central dominance. Creatures so violent and uncontrollable that the Lord Ruler had been forced to keep them away from civilization. Seizid extinguished his tin mind, welcoming the return to normal vision. He had to get to Luthadel and warn the others. If they... Seizid froze. One problem with enhancing his vision was that he temporarily lost the ability to see close up. So it wasn't odd that he hadn't noticed the Koloss patrol surrounding his aspens.
By the forgotten gods!
He held firm to the tip of the tree, thinking quickly. Several Koloss were already pushing their way into the stand. If he dropped to the ground, he'd be too slow to escape. As always, he wore a pewter mind. He could easily become as strong as 10 men and maintain it for a good amount of time. He could fight, perhaps. Yet the Koloss carried crude-looking but massive swords. Sazed's notes, his memory, and his lore all agreed. Koloss were very dangerous warriors. Strong as 10 men or not, Sazed wouldn't have the skill to defeat them.
"Come down," called a deep, slurred voice from below. "Come down now."
Sazed looked down. A large Koloss, skin just beginning to stretch, stood at the tree's base. It gave the aspen a shake.
"Come down now," the creature repeated.
"The lips don't work very well," Sazed thought. "He sounds like a man trying to talk without moving his lips."
He wasn't surprised that the creature could talk. His notes mentioned that. He was, however, surprised at how calm it sounded.
"I could run," he thought.
He could keep to the tops of trees, perhaps cross the distance between patches of aspens by dropping his metal mines and trying to ride gusts of wind. But it would be very difficult, and very unpredictable. And he would have to leave his copper mines, 1,000 years of history, behind. So, pewter mind ready in case he needed strength, Sazed let go of the tree. The Koloss leader, Sazed could only assume that was what he was, watched Sazed fall to the ground with a red-eyed stare. The creature did not blink. Sazed wondered if it even could blink, its skin stretched as it was. Sazed plunked to the ground beside the tree, then reached for his pack.
"No!"
the Koloss snapped, grabbing the pack with an inhumanly quick swipe of the arm. It tossed the pack to another Koloss.
"I need that," Sazed said. "I will be much more cooperative if..."
"Quiet!"
the Koloss yelled with a rage so sudden that Sazed took a step backward. Terrasmen were tall, especially Terrasmen eunuchs, and it was very disconcerting to be dwarfed by this beastly creature, well over 9 feet in height, its skin a blackish blue, its eyes the color of the sun at dusk. It loomed over Sazed, and he cringed in spite of himself. Apparently that was the proper reaction, for the lead Koloss nodded and turned away.
"Come,"
it slurred, lumbering through the small aspen forest. The other Koloss, about 7 of them, followed. Sazed didn't want to find out what would happen if he disobeyed. He chose a god, Duis, a god once said to watch over wearied travelers, and said a quick, silent prayer. Then he hurried forward, staying with the pack of Koloss as they walked toward the camp.
"At least they didn't kill me out of hand," Sazed thought.
He'd half expected that, considering what he'd read. Of course, even the books didn't know much. The Koloss had been kept separate from mankind for centuries. The Lord Ruler only called upon them in times of great martial need, to quell revolts or to conquer new societies discovered on the inner islands. At those times, the Koloss had caused absolute destruction and slaughter, or so the histories claimed.
"Could all that have been propaganda?" Sazed wondered. "Maybe the Koloss aren't as violent as we assumed."
One of the Koloss beside Sazed howled in sudden anger. Sazed spun as the Koloss jumped at one of its companions. The creature ignored the sword on its back, instead punching his enemy's head with a blocky fist. The others paused, turning to watch the fight, but none of them seemed alarmed. Sazed watched with growing horror as the aggressor proceeded to repeatedly pummel his enemy. The defender tried to protect himself, getting out a dagger and managing to score a cut on the aggressor's arm. The blue skin tore, seeping bright red blood as the aggressor got his hands around his opponent's thick head and twisted. There was a snap. The defender stopped moving. The aggressor removed the sword from his victim's back and strapped it on beside his own weapon, then removed a small pouch that was tied beside the sword. After that, he stood, ignoring the wound on his arm, and the group began to walk again.
"Why?" Sazed asked, shocked. "What was that for?"
The wounded Kolos turned around.
"I hated him," he said.
"Move!"
the lead Kolos snapped at Sazed. Sazed forced himself to start walking. They left the corpse lying in the road.
"The pouches," he thought, trying to find something to focus on besides the brutality. "They all carry those pouches."
The Kolos kept them tied to their swords. They didn't carry the weapons in sheaths. They were simply bound on their backs with leather straps. And tied to those straps were pouches. Sometimes there was just one, though the two largest creatures in the group each had several.
"They look like coin pouches," Sazed thought. "But the Kolos don't have an economy. Perhaps they keep personal possessions in them? But what would beasts like these value?"
They entered the camp. There didn't appear to be sentries at the borders, but then why would guards be necessary? It would be very difficult for a human to sneak into this camp. A group of smaller Kolos, the 5-foot-tall ones, rushed forward as soon as the group arrived. The murderer threw his extra sword to one of them, then pointed into the distance. He kept the pouch for himself, and the small ones rushed off, following the road in the direction of the body.
"Burial detail?" Sazed wondered.
He walked uncomfortably behind his captors as they penetrated into the camp. Beasts of all sorts were being roasted over the fire pits, though Sazed didn't think any of them had once been human. In addition, the ground around the camp had been completely stripped of plant life, as if it had been grazed by a group of particularly aggressive goats. And, according to his copper mind, that wasn't far off the truth. Kolos could apparently subsist on practically anything. They preferred meat, but would eat any kind of plant, even grass, going so far as to pull it up by the roots to eat. Some reports even spoke of them eating dirt and ash, though Sazed found that a little difficult to believe. He continued to walk. The camp smelled of smoke, grime, and a strange musk that he assumed was Kolos body odor. Some of the creatures turned as he passed, watching him with steady red eyes.
"It's like they only have two emotions," he thought, jumping as a fireside Kolos suddenly screamed and attacked a companion. "They're either indifferent, or they're enraged."
What would it take to set them all off at once? And what kind of a disaster would they cause if that happened? He nervously revised his earlier thoughts. No, the Kolos had not been maligned. The stories he had heard, stories of Kolos running wild in the Farmost dominance, causing widespread destruction and death, were obviously true. But something kept this group marginally reined in. The Lord Ruler had been able to control the Kolos, though no book explained how. Most writers simply accepted this ability as part of what had made the Lord Ruler God. The man had been immortal. Compared with that, other powers seemed mundane.
"His immortality, however, was a trick," Sazed thought. "Simply a clever combination of ferrochemical and allomantic powers."
The Lord Ruler had just been a normal man, albeit one with an unusual combination of abilities and opportunities. That being the case, how had he controlled the Kolos?
"There was something different about the Lord Ruler. Something more than his powers. He did something at the Well of Ascension. Something that forever changed the world. Perhaps his ability to control the Kolos came from that."
Sazed's captors ignored the occasional fights around fire pits. There didn't appear to be any female Kolos in the camp, or if there were, they were indistinguishable from the males. Sazed did, however, notice a Kolos corpse lying forgotten near one of the fires. It had been flayed, the blue skin ripped free.
How could any society exist like this? He thought with horror. His books said the Koloss bred and aged quickly. A fortunate situation for them, considering the number of deaths he had already seen. Even so, it seemed to him that this species killed too many of its members to continue. Yet they did continue. Unfortunately. The keeper in him believed strongly that nothing should be lost, that every society was worth remembering. However, the brutality of the Koloss camp, the wounded creatures who sat ignoring the gashes in their skin, the flayed corpses along the path, the sudden bellows of anger and subsequent murders, tested this belief. His captors led him around a small hillock in the land, and Sazed paused as he saw something very unexpected. A tent.
Go,
the lead Koloss said, pointing. Sazed frowned. There were several dozen humans outside the tent, carrying spears and dressed like imperial guards. The tent was large, and behind it stood a line of boxy carts.
Go!
The Koloss yelled. Sazed did as he was told. Behind him, one of the Koloss indifferently tossed Sazed's pack toward the human guards. The metal mines inside clinked together as they hit the ashy ground, causing Sazed to cringe. The soldiers watched the Koloss retreat with a wary eye. Then one picked up the pack. Another leveled his spear at Sazed. Sazed held up his hands.
I am Sazed, a keeper of Terris, once steward, now teacher. I am not your enemy.
Yes, well, the guard said, still watching the retreating Koloss. You're still going to have to come with me.
May I have my possessions back? Sazed asked.
This hollow appeared free of Koloss. Apparently the human soldiers wanted to keep their distance. The first guard turned to his companion, who was perusing Sazed's pack. The second guard looked up and shrugged.
No weapons. Some bracelets and rings. Maybe worth something.
None of them are of precious metals, Sazed said. They are the tools of a keeper, and are of little value to anyone but myself.
The second guard shrugged, handing the bag to the first man. Both were of standard central dominance coloring, dark hair, light skin, the build and height of those who'd had proper nutrition as children. The first guard was the older of the two, and was obviously in charge. He took the bag from his companion.
We'll see what His Majesty says.
Ah, Sazed thought. Let us speak with him, then.
The guard turned, pushing aside the tent door and motioning for Sazed to enter. Sazed stepped from red sunlight into a functional, if sparsely furnished, tent room. This main chamber was large and contained several more guards. Sazed had seen perhaps 24 so far. The lead guard walked forward and poked his head into a room at the back. A few moments later, he waved Sazed forward and pulled back the tent door. Sazed entered the second chamber. The man inside wore the pants and suit jacket of a Luthadel nobleman. He was balding, his hair reduced to a few struggling wisps, despite his youth. He stood, tapping the side of his leg with a nervous hand, and jumped slightly when Sazed entered. Sazed recognized the man.
Justice Lekal.
King Lekal, Justice snapped. Do I know you, Terrasman?
We have not met, Your Majesty, Sazed said. But I have had some dealings with a friend of yours, I think. King Elland Venture of Luthadel?
Justice nodded absently.
My men say the Koloss brought you. They found you poking around the camp?
Yes, Your Majesty, Sazed said carefully,
watching as Justice began to pace.
This man isn't much more stable than the army he apparently leads, he thought with dissatisfaction.
How is it that you have persuaded the creatures to serve you? You are a prisoner, Terrasman, Justice snapped. No questions. Did Elland send you to spy on me?
I was sent by no man, Sazed said. You happened to be in my path, Your Majesty. I meant no harm by my observations.
Justice paused,
eyeing Sazed before beginning to pace again. "Well, never mind. I've been without a proper steward for some time now. You will serve me now."
"I apologize, Your Majesty," Sazed said, bowing slightly. "But that will not be possible."
Jastis frowned. "You're a steward. I can tell that from the robes. Is Elend so great a master that you would deny me?"
"Elend Venture is not my master, Your Majesty," Sazed said, meeting the young king's eyes. "Now that we are free, the Terrasmen no longer call any man master. I cannot be your servant, for I can be no man's servant. Keep me as prisoner if you must, but I will not serve you. I apologize."
Jastis paused again. Instead of being angry, however, he simply seemed embarrassed.
"I see." "Your Majesty," Sazed said calmly, "I realize that you commanded me to ask no questions, so I will instead make observations. You appear to have placed yourself in a very poor position. I know not how you control these Koloss, but I cannot help but think that your grip is tenuous. You are in danger, and you appear intent on sharing that danger with others."
Jastis flushed.
"Your observations are flawed, Terrasmen. I am in control of this army. They obey me completely. How many other noblemen have you seen gather Koloss armies? None. Only I have been successful."
"They do not seem very much under control, Your Majesty."
"Oh?" Jastis asked. "And did they tear you apart when they found you? Pummel you to death for sport? Ram a stick through you and roast you over one of their fires?" "No. They don't do these things because I commanded them otherwise. It may not seem like much, Terrasmen, but they trust me. This is a sign of great restraint and obedience for Koloss."
"Civilization is no great achievement, Your Majesty."
"Do not try me, Terrasmen," Jastis snapped, running a hand through the remnants of his hair. "These are Koloss we speak of. We can't expect much from them."
"And you bring them to Luthadel?" Sazed asked. "Even the Lord Ruler feared these creatures, Your Majesty. He kept them away from cities. You bring them to the most populated area in all of the Final Empire."
"You don't understand," Jastis said. "I tried overtures of peace, but nobody listens unless you have money or an army. Well, I have one, and I'll soon have the other. I know Ellen's sitting on that stash of Atium, and I've just come to make an alliance with him."
"An alliance where you take control of the city?"
"Bah!" Jastis said with a wave of his hand. "Elend doesn't control Luthadel. He's just a placeholder waiting for someone more powerful to come along. He's a good man, but he's an innocent idealist. He's going to lose his throne to one army or another, and I'll give him a better deal than Set or Straff will, that's certain."
"Set? Straff? What kind of trouble has young Venture gotten himself into?"
Sazed shook his head.
"Somehow I doubt that a better deal involves the use of Koloss, Your Majesty."
Jastis frowned. "You certainly are smart-mouthed, Terrasmen. You're a sign, your entire people are a sign of what has gone wrong with the world. I used to respect the Terrace people. There's no shame in being a good servant."
"There's often little pride in it either," Sazed said. "But I apologize for my attitude, Your Majesty. It is not a manifestation of Terrace independence. I have always been too free with my comments, I think. I never made the best of stewards."
"Or the best of keepers," he added to himself. "Bah!" Jastis said again, resuming his pacing.
"Your Majesty," Sazed said, "I must continue to Luthadel. There are events I need to deal with. Think what you will of my people, but you must know that we are honest. The work I do is beyond politics and wars, thrones and armies. It is important for all men."
"Scholars always say things like that," Jastis said. He paused. Elend, always said things like that. Regardless, Sazed continued, I must be allowed to leave. In exchange for my freedom, I will deliver a message from you to His Majesty King Elend, if you wish.
I could send a messenger of my own at any time.
And leave yourself with one less man to protect you from the Koloss, Sazed said.
Jastis paused just briefly.
Ah, so he does fear them. Good. At least he's not insane. I will be leaving, Your Majesty, Sazed said. I do not mean to be arrogant, but I can see that you don't have the resources to keep prisoners. You can let me go, or you can give me to the Koloss. I would be wary, however, of letting them get into a habit of killing humans.
Jastis eyed him.
Fine, he said. Deliver this message, then. Tell Elend that I don't care if he knows I'm coming. I don't even care if you give our numbers. Be sure you're accurate, though. I have over 20,000 Koloss in this army. He can't fight me. He can't fight the others, either. But if I had those city walls, well, I could hold off both other armies for him. Tell him to be logical. If he gives over the Atium, I'll even let him keep Luthadel. We can be neighbors. Allies.
One bankrupt of coin, the other bankrupt of common sense, Sazed thought. Very well, Your Majesty. I will speak with Elend. I will need the return of my possessions, however.
The king waved a hand in annoyance, and Sazed withdrew, waiting quietly as the lead guard entered the king's chambers again and received his orders. As he waited for the soldiers to prepare, his pack thankfully returned to him, Sazed thought about what Jastis had said.
Set or Straff?
Just how many forces were working on Elend to take his city? If Sazed had wanted a quiet place to study, he'd apparently chosen the wrong direction to run.
It wasn't until a few years later that I began to notice the signs. I knew the prophecies. I am a Terrace Worldbringer, after all. And yet, not all of us are religious men. Some, such as myself, are more interested in other topics. However, during my time with Elendi, I could not help but become more interested in the anticipation. He seemed to fit the signs so well.
20.
This is going to be dangerous, Your Majesty, Doxson said.
It's our only option, Elend said. He stood behind his table. It was, as usual, stacked with books. He was backlit by the study's window, and its colors fell upon the back of his white uniform, dyeing it a brilliant maroon.
He certainly does look more commanding in that outfit, Vin thought, sitting in Elend's plush reading chair, Orsier resting patiently on the floor beside her.
She still wasn't sure what to think of the changes in Elend. She knew the alterations were mostly visual, new clothing, new haircut, but other things about him seemed to be changing as well. He stood up straighter when he spoke, and was more authoritative. He was even training in the sword and the cane. Vin glanced at Tyndall. The matronly terrace woman sat in a stiff chair at the back of the room, watching the proceedings. She had perfect posture, and was ladylike in her colorful skirt and blouse. She didn't sit with her legs folded beneath her, as Vin currently did, and she'd never wear trousers.
What is it about her? Vin thought. I've spent a year trying to get Elend to practice his swordsmanship. Tyndall's been here less than a month, and she already has him sparring.
Why did Vin feel bitter? Elend wouldn't change that much, would he? She tried to quiet the little piece of her that worried about this new, confident, well-dressed warrior of a king. Worried that he would turn out to be different from the man she loved. What if he stopped needing her? She pulled down into the chair just a little bit farther as Elend continued to speak with Ham, Dox, Clubs, and Breeze.
"El," Ham said, "you realize that if you go into the enemy camp,
we won't be able to protect you. I'm not sure you can protect me here, Ham, Ellen said, not with two armies camped practically against the walls.
True, Doxson said, but I'm worried that if you enter that camp, you'll never come out.
Only if I fail, Ellen said. If I follow the plan, convince my father that we're his allies, he'll let me return. I didn't spend a lot of time politicking in the court when I was younger. However, one thing I did learn to do was manipulate my father. I know Straff Venture, and I know that I can beat him. Besides, he doesn't want me dead.
Can we be sure of that? Ham asked, rubbing his chin.
Yes, Ellen said. After all, Straff hasn't sent assassins after me while Set has. It makes sense. What better person for Straff to leave in control of Luthadel than his own son? He thinks he can control me. He'll assume that he can make me give him Luthadel. If I play into that, I should be able to get him to attack Set.
He does have a point, Ham said.
Yes, Doxson said. But what is to keep Straff from just taking you hostage and forcing his way into Luthadel?
He'll still have Set at his back, Ellen said. If he fights us, he'll lose men, a lot of men, and expose himself to attack from behind.
But he'll have you, my dear man, Breeze said. He wouldn't have to attack Luthadel. He could force us to give in.
You'll have orders to let me die first, Ellen said. That's why I set up the assembly. It has the power to choose a new king.
But why? Ham asked. Why take this risk, El? Let's wait a bit longer and see if we can get Straff to meet with you in a more neutral location.
Ellen sighed.
You have to listen to me, Ham. Siege or no siege, we can't just sit here.
If we do, either we'll get starved out, or one of those armies will decide to break the siege and attack us, hoping to take our walls, then turn and immediately defend against its enemies. They won't do that easily, but it could happen. It will happen if we don't begin to play the kings against one another.
The room fell silent. The others slowly turned toward Clubs, who nodded. He agreed.
Good job, Ellen, Vin thought.
Someone has to meet with my father, Ellen said. And I need to be that person. Straff thinks I'm a fool, so I can convince him that I'm no threat. Then I'll go and persuade Set that I'm on his side. When they finally attack each other, each one thinking we're on their side, we'll withdraw instead and force them to fight it out. The winner won't have enough strength left to take the city from us.
Ham and Breeze nodded their heads. Doxson, however, shook his.
The plan is good in theory, but going into the enemy camp unguarded? That seems foolish.
Now see, Ellen said. I think this is to our advantage. My father believes strongly in control and domination. If I walk into his camp, I'll essentially be telling him that I agree he has authority over me. I'll seem weak, and he'll assume that he can take me whenever he wants. It's a risk, but if I don't do this, we die.
The men eyed each other. Ellen stood up a little straighter and pulled his hands into fists at his sides. He always did that when he was nervous.
I'm afraid that this isn't a discussion, Ellen said. I've made my decision.
They're not going to accept a declaration like that, Vin thought. The crew were an independent lot.
Yet surprisingly, none of them objected.
Doxson finally nodded his head.
All right, Your Majesty, he said. You're going to need to walk a dangerous line. Make Straff believe that he can count on our support, but also convince him that he can betray us at his leisure. You have to make him want our strength of arms while at the same time dismissing our strength of will.
And, Breeze added, you need to do so without him figuring out that you're playing both sides.
Can you do it? Ham asked.
Honestly, Ellen.
Ellen nodded.
I can do it, Ham. I've gotten much better at politics this last year.
He said the words with confidence, though Vin noticed that he still had his fists clenched. He'll have to learn not to do that.
"You may perhaps understand politics," Breeze said, "but this is scamming. Face it, my friend, you're dreadfully honest, always talking about how to defend the rights of Scar and the like."
"Now see, you're being unfair," Ellen said. "Honesty and good intentions are completely different. Why, I can be just as dishonest as..." He paused. "Why am I arguing this point? We admit what has to be done, and we know that I'm the one who has to do it. Docs, would you draft a letter to my father? Suggest that I would be happy to visit him. In fact..."
Ellen paused, glancing at Vin. Then he continued.
"In fact, tell him that I want to discuss the future of Luthadel, and because I want to introduce him to someone special."
Ham chuckled.
"Ah, nothing like bringing a girl home to meet the father.
Especially when that girl happens to be the most dangerous Allomancer in the Central Dominance," Breeze added.
"You think he'll agree to letting her come?" Doxson said.
"If he doesn't, there's no deal," Ellen said. "Make sure he knows that. Either way, I do think he'll agree. Straff has a habit of underestimating me, probably with good reason. However, I'll bet that sentiment extends to Vin as well. He'll assume she isn't as good as everyone says."
"Straff has his own Mistborn," Vin added, "to protect him. It will only be fair for Ellen to be able to bring me. And if I'm there, I can get him out should something go wrong."
Ham chuckled again.
"That probably wouldn't make for a very dignified retreat, getting slung over Vin's shoulder and carried to safety."
"Better than dying," Ellen said, obviously trying to act good-natured, but flushing slightly at the same time.
"He loves me, but he's still a man," Vin thought. "How many times have I hurt his pride by being Mistborn, while he is simply a normal person? A lesser man would never have fallen in love with me. But doesn't he deserve a woman that he feels he can protect? A woman who's more like... a woman?"
Vin pulled down in her chair again, seeking warmth within its plushness. However, it was Ellen's study chair, where he read. Didn't he also deserve a woman who shared his interests? One who didn't find reading a chore? A woman with whom he could talk about his brilliant political theories?
"Why am I thinking about our relationship so much lately?" Vin thought.
"We don't belong in their world," Zane had said. "We belong here, in the mists. You don't belong with them."
"There is something else I wanted to mention, Your Majesty," Doxson said. "You should meet with the Assembly. They've been growing impatient to get your ear. Something about counterfeit coins being passed in Luthadel."
"I don't really have time for city business right now," Ellen said. "The prime reason I set up the Assembly was so that they could deal with these kinds of issues. Go ahead and send them a message, telling them that I trust their judgment. Apologize for me and explain that I'm seeing to the city's defense. I'll try and make the Assembly meeting next week."
Doxson nodded, scribbling a note to himself.
"Though," he noted, "that is something else to consider. By meeting with Straff, you'll give up your hold on the Assembly."
"This isn't an official parley," Ellen said. "Just an informal meeting. My resolution from before will still stand."
"In all honesty, Your Majesty," Doxson said, "I highly doubt that they will see it that way. You know how angry they are to be left without recourse until you decide to hold the parley."
"I know," Ellen said, "but the risk is worthwhile. We need to meet with Straff. Once that is done, I can return with, hopefully, good news for the Assembly. At that point, I can argue that the resolution hasn't been fulfilled. For now, the meeting goes forward." More decisive indeed, Vin thought. He's changing.
She had to stop thinking about things like that. Instead, she focused on something else. The conversation turned to specific ways that Ellen could manipulate Straff, each of the crew members giving him tips on how to scam effectively. Vin, however, found herself watching them, looking for discrepancies in their personalities, trying to decide if any of them might be the Chondra spy. Was Clubs being even quieter than normal? Was Spook's shift in language patterns due to growing maturity, or because the Chandra had difficulty mimicking his slang. Was Ham perhaps too jovial? He also seemed to focus less on his little philosophical puzzles than he once had. Was that because he was more serious now, or because the Chandra didn't know how to imitate him properly? It was no good. If she thought too much, she could spot seeming discrepancies in anyone. Yet at the same time, they all seemed like themselves. People were just too complex to reduce to simple personality traits. Plus, the Chandra would be good, very good. He would have a lifetime of training in the art of imitating others, and he had probably been planning his insertion for a long time. It came down to allomancy, then. With all of the activities surrounding the siege and her studies about the deepness, however, she hadn't had a chance to test her friends. As she thought about it, she admitted that the lack of time excuse was a weak one. The truth was that she was probably distracting herself because the thought of one of the crew, one of her first group of friends, being a traitor, was just too upsetting. She had to get over that. If there really were a spy in the group, that would be the end of them. If the enemy kings found out about the tricks Elend was planning... This in mind, she tentatively burned bronze. Immediately, she sensed an allomantic pulse from Breeze. Dear, incorrigible Breeze. He was so good at allomancy that even Vin couldn't detect his touch most of the time. But he was also compulsive about using his power. He wasn't currently using it on her, however. She closed her eyes, focusing. Once, long ago, Marsh had tried to train her in the fine art of using bronze to read allomantic pulses. She hadn't realized at the time just how large a task he'd begun. When an allomancer burned a metal, they gave off an invisible, drum-like beat that only another allomancer burning bronze could sense. The rhythm of these pulses, how quickly the beats came, the way they sounded, told exactly what metal was being burned.